This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs.
So, how do you reach the Chinese businessman with a TV commercial?
That was Eric Rosenkranz, former vice chairman of Focus Media China and longtime senior advertising executive. He's had an extraordinary career, rising through the ranks of one of the world's great advertising agencies before throwing it all in to dedicate himself to Asian startups. It's an unlikely career transition, made possible to some degree by an opportune moment when he was asked by an unlikely Chinese entrepreneur to join the board of an innovative media company in order to help secure a listing on NASDAQ. The timing was perfect, and Eric and the founder watched shares of their company soar at a time when investing in Chinese companies was all the fashion. For some, that might have been a fitting last act and a career well plied. Not for Eric. He instead chose to pivot and threw himself out of the comfort zone and into the world of startups, where he has mentored, funded, and advised scores of young Singapore and Southeast Asian companies in search of the dream. But rather than my telling you the story, I'm going to let him do it. As is always the case on Inside Asia, I'm not in a studio, but on the ground, this time in the offices of one of Singapore's original startup incubators. There's a kind of curiosity in Eric, typically reserved for those fresh out of college and looking for the new thing. He was keen to get talking and even made a grab for my mic as the interview got underway.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Thanks for inviting me. And
don't touch my mic, okay? Yeah. I saw you reach for the mic. I'm going to ask you not to do that.
That's okay, right. But I'm the type of guy who always wants to control the mic.
I know. I sense this immediately, so we'll see how this goes. All right, so stay tuned there, listeners. Here we go. Eric, over to you.
So we're here in a godown in Singapore. Godown, I've just looked it up, is a Malaysian word, which means warehouse. And we're in these buildings are, it's a very old place. I wish your viewers could see it. It's an old place next to one of the most modern office high-rises in Singapore. But this building must be, I don't know, 50 years old with exposed plumbing, and I could see the air conditioning ducts now. And this building was set aside by the Singapore government for incubators, for startups, for angel groups about 5-6 years ago. It has the terribly sexy name of Block 67 because the address is Block 67. And we're in the office of a angel funder, a VC called Expara, which is one of the oldest VCs in Singapore focused on startups. They've been doing this for about 15 years. And their sweet spot is investing in startups throughout all of Southeast Asia. You know, $50,000, $100,000, $300,000, something like that. And they kindly allowed us to use their space today.
And here you are as a guy who's been in the region for many, many years now. Like you came out of an advertising background. You were at media giant Gray Global Group for many, many years. An ad man by every measure of the word. And here you are, you know, years later, sitting in a go-down, as we call it, in Singapore, dealing with startups. First of all, how did you arrive in Asia? And second, why are you now doing startups and not large corporate gigs?
Well, I think if startups had existed when I was graduating, I probably would have done that right away. But I got an MBA when I was 22 years old in the 70s, and there were no jobs. And what did I know when I was 22 years old? I didn't know anything. I interviewed, my specialty was long-range corporate forecasting. So I was interviewing with the giants, Xerox, IBM, and I found, and you're going to like this, Steve, as a executive recruiter, you do a lot of interviewing, right? I was interviewing at Xerox and IBM, and I found I was bored during the interview.
What was happening? Is it the people or was it you?
I was bored with the people who I was interviewing with. Well,
because of what they did or just you didn't?
Their whole attitude, their style, their characteristics, the way they talk, the way they ask me questions. I was 22-year-old kid and I was falling asleep in the interviews.
Yes, it's not a good sign, you realize
no.
that.
No. Okay. And I made this link in my mind that if I was bored with these people, I'd be bored with the work they're doing.
Okay.
So I spoke to somebody at my university. And they said, go interview at an ad agency. And I didn't know the first thing about advertising, not the first thing. So I had an interview with an ad agency, and I said to myself, I really like this guy. I enjoy talking to him. I'll bet I'll enjoy the work he's doing.
And now, was this based on just kind of appearances, or when you go in at agencies?
Just the feeling, the back and forth, the repartee, the casualness. Okay. And so I went into advertising, not knowing the first thing, and I guess not knowing anything about a subject may be good, because I spent the next 30 years of my life in the advertising world.
Oh, interesting. And then Asia, how did you arrive in this part?
So in 1982, I went to my company and I said, I'm bored. I guess boredom is the theme here.
I hope not. Please continue.
I hope your listeners aren't bored. And I went to my company. I was working in Chicago at the time. And I said, send me somewhere. I want to see the world. And they sent me to Mexico. And the next thing you know, I had this international career. That was 1982. I haven't been back to the States since. So I moved all around the world with Gray Global Group. And eventually, I first came to Asia in the 1980s, where I was running our office in Japan. But then in 2000, they sent me back to Asia as CEO of Asia, based in Hong Kong. And in 2004, we sold the company for $1 billion. So I said to my wife, got some money, sweetheart. I don't have to work another day in my life.
Tell us a little bit about that. What were the circumstances around that merger and what occurred afterward?
Well, what happened was that the whole advertising industry was going through a shake-up, or shakedown, as you were, and you had 20, 30 big giants, and they were all being merged and consolidated into big groups. And the driving force was efficiencies and economies of scale, especially in media buying. And my company was the last remaining independent company. We were a $1 billion company. We were the only independent left. And we used to refer to ourselves as the last girl in the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you could go home with anybody you want.
Right.
Finally, somebody made us an offer, and our chairman and the controlling shareholder was, I don't know, said 75 or so at the time, and he decided it was time to, sell out. And so we sold to a big conglomerate, as I said, for $1 billion. I was CEO of Asia, and I made the decision that I didn't want to work for the big conglomerate, that I was very happy in my career working for this independent but small mom-and-pop $1 billion company, and I didn't want to go to some big conglomerate.
And those are the end of your advertising days as well. You kind of threw it in at that point and said...
So I said, if I don't want to stay and work for this new owner, and I don't want to go work for another big conglomerate, time to move on and try something else. So at the age of 52, I totally shifted gears and started a new career.
And what was that career, and how did you come across it?
Well, I have a lot of friends in different industries, who all somewhere around their 50s or so, whether it's they decide to move on or their company decides to move them on, they find themselves out of work. And they struggle for a year or so until they find the right connection and where to go next. And that was with me. I founded a company called E3, which is a strategic advisory. And my initial idea was to give strategic advice to big corporations, which is what I had done my whole career.
In the advertising space or across any area?
I was expanding beyond advertising to the idea of the corporate strategy. Right. So if you're a company, most companies are very good at setting an annual plan. What am I going to do next year? What most companies are not good at is saying, here's where I want to be in 5 years or 10 years. And if you don't know where you're going in 5 years, how can you really decide where you're going next year? You need that long-term vision before you can make your short-term decisions.
But a lot of this was being done, the Bains, McKinsey's, Booz, they were all kind of offering a strategy at a high level. What were you offering that was different? Or is it just based on experience you had in the market that's something you could bring to the table that perhaps the others couldn't?
That's why you're a great interviewer, Steve, because that's an excellent question. The majority of the reports, or I should say the majority of the recommendations that a McKinsey or a Bain or a BCG recommend to their clients get rejected, or I should say it differently, do not get implemented. In fact, I saw one study that said 90% do not get implemented. Okay, why? You're the CEO of a company, you hire McKinsey, you pay them $10 million, McKinsey comes back 6 months later with this report that's 10 inches thick and says, do this, and you and your team have no ownership of that. And so there's no interest in doing it, and it ends up getting put in a drawer. The idea behind my strategic consultancy, and believe me, I wasn't trying to compete with McKinsey of the world, The idea behind my strategic consultancy was to work with the company and have their team put together a strategy so they would have ownership of it, but it would be under my guidance and under my mentorship.
So facilitated.
So I would facilitate their creating their strategy. Because I think the only people who could develop their own strategy are the company themselves, not an outside third person.
Yeah, yeah. And how did that go? Were you able to market yourself up front, or did it take a little more time than you expected?
It went well. But circumstances overtook it.
Right.
So after about a year or two of doing this, a mate of mine, now there's a very big, in fact, I think at the time they were the largest VC in Europe, a company called 3i, based in the UK. And 3i had Asian headquarters set up in Hong Kong. And the head of Asia, the CEO of Asia for 3i, was my next door neighbor when I was living in Hong Kong. Mm. Now, by this point, I had already moved to Singapore and set up E3. And he called me up one day and said that 3i had been, this is 2004, by the way, 3i had been asked to invest $10 million in the Series C round for a privately held Chinese media company. Mm. They didn't know the first thing about media, or 3i didn't, so would I lead the due diligence for them?
Just out of the blue, like that. You're a media guy. You now have an advisory company. Yeah. We found our guy.
Right. So this guy, who was my next door neighbor for 4 years in Hong Kong, and you know, we dog sat and we, you know, looked at each other's apartment when, you know, here's my key. I'm going away for 2 weeks. Check out my apartment. Never talked a day of business in my life. He calls me up and says, "I'd like to lead the due diligence for this $10 million round of funding."
Yeah. Now stand by on this one, because this is an amazing story. Because how this all came together and the way that it came off is almost unprecedented, wouldn't you say?
So, well, I don't know about unprecedented. This is my story, and I'm going to stick to it. So, I do the due diligence, and I recommend that 3i invest the $10 million. And my job's done. I get paid a little fee. So, a month later, I get a phone call from the founder and CEO of the Chinese company.
And what did the Chinese company do?
So I'll get to that in a second.
Oh, sorry, I won't. Okay. Sorry, don't want to push
it. I'll tell you now. So it was a company called Focus Media.
Yeah.
And what they did was put television screens in the lift lobby of office buildings and run advertising.
Right. And that wasn't happening at that point. It just started. And they were the only company.
It just started. It was not being done anywhere else in the world. Right. This guy came up with the idea. And in fact, the way he came up with the idea, I'm going to do a little bit of a divergence. We're going to come back to the main part of the story.
It's all about a startup at the end of the day.
Right. So he was sitting on an airplane one day, okay, a domestic flight in China, and he was bored. And he picked up...
There's the boredom thing again.
And he picked up the in-flight magazine. Now, Steve, have you ever looked at the in-flight magazine on any airline?
Once, when I was bored.
Right. Because they're the worst publications in the world.
Yes.
And he read it from cover to cover because he had nothing else to read. And he realized as he was reading it that this was the worst magazine ever, but he was reading it because he had nothing else to do. Okay, now, in 2004, actually this was 2002, in China, the average household only had one television set. You know, in Europe and America, we have 2.3 or 3.4 TVs. The average household only had one television set. All of the programming was geared to the wife. And the husband never came home because he was out doing karaoke, doing business dinners, whatever. When he did come home, he couldn't watch TV because his wife controlled the remote control, and there was no programs he wanted to watch anyway.
This is statistically proven. They actually did research on this, right?
I've got all the research on this. Okay. Got all the numbers. Okay. So, 2002, how do you reach the Chinese businessman with a TV commercial? Okay, if you're a credit card company, or you're a bank, or a phone company, or a real estate company, or a car company, how do you advertise to this guy? He can't be reached with TV. Now, get back to the in-flight magazine. So now I need to talk to you about buildings in China. Okay, a typical high-rise in China has twice as many people per floor as a building in the West, and has half the number of elevators.
Really?
Yeah. And I've got the numbers.
I wasn't questioning you.
So with twice the people and half the number of elevators, you've got four times the problem. And so, and I've actually timed this. If you push a button in an elevator in a lift lobby of an office building in New York or London, the elevator comes in 7 seconds. In China at the time, it took 2.2 minutes. And there were literally queues where you'd queue up to get into an elevator. You know, 20 people would get into the elevator, would take off, and you would march up in the queue. And sometimes you'd have to wait for 8 or 10 elevators.
And your average ad spot's 30 seconds, right?
Average ad is 30 seconds. Yeah. So in 2.2 minutes, you can run 4 ads.
Geared towards men going to the office, and you don't need a remote control.
You don't need the remote control, and these are where the men are. They're sitting in the lobbies of their office buildings, and they go up in the morning, they come down for lunch, they go back up in the afternoon, maybe they come back after dinner. So there's like 3 opportunities to get them per day for 2.2 minutes.
This is your friend's brainchild. Right. So he's actually thinking, you know, on these plane trips, I could do something about this.
Exactly. And he's 31 years old, right? Now, this is also before smartphones. So today, if you're waiting, you whip out your phone and you play a game, you check your emails, you look at Facebook. They didn't exist in 2002.
There was nothing to do.
There was nothing to do except look at the ads.
Right.
He created a billion-dollar business.
Yeah.
Okay, because he was bored and he said, if people will read the stupid in-flight magazine, they'll look at my ads because they have nothing else to do.
And he knew you were the media guy and you could figure this out because you were all about eyeballs and advertising and you understood the sponsors, you understood the advertising game.
Yes, but that's not why he wanted me.
I'm Steve Stein and this is the Incubating Asia episode. My guest is Eric Rosenkrantz. We have to step away for a moment and when we come back, the rest of the story and why Eric's Chinese friend and media entrepreneur needed him to join forces.
He didn't need me to teach him about media in China. He needed me as a gray-haired, experienced Westerner who could go talk to the bankers in language they would understand. So I became the vice chairman of the company and led the NASDAQ listing.
Fascinating. And you boarded, you went full-time with them at that point?
No, I was still doing my other stuff.
Okay.
I was still running E3 and I had other clients, so I wasn't full-time. But as we were getting closer, it ended up being full-time. You know, I never formally moved to Shanghai, but I was spending 80% of my time there as we were preparing for the launch. And it was interesting because I think today, we're now in 2017, I think people in the West, in America and Europe, are more, you know, understanding and acknowledging about Chinese and foreigners and all. Boy, this was 2005 we launched, we listed on NASDAQ. People didn't understand it at all. And there was racism and biases. So we would go into pitches with investors and they wouldn't even look at my chairman and founder, okay, because he was Chinese.
Right.
Okay, they would only talk to me. Okay, we had one, I'll never forget, I won't mention the company, but it was an investor in San Francisco who was gonna put in hundreds of millions of dollars into the business, and they wouldn't look at this guy. He's 33 years old. He's got, you know, different colored eyes than he does. He only would talk to me.
But was he, you know, was the founder well aware of this? Could he feel it, did he sense it, or did he digest it and understand the game?
I'm sorry, do you wanna ask that question?
No, did he understand the game? He understood that, or did he take umbrage at all that?
The founder was and is a purely practical guy. He was out to make a fortune. He doesn't take umbrage at anything. And I remember very specifically this one meeting we each had. There was myself, him, and our CFO, and we each had roles to play in the presentation. Within 5 minutes, it was completely obvious that the guy we were pitching to wasn't even going to look at the chairman. And you know what he did? He shut up.
Yeah.
Our CFO was also Chinese. He shut up. And they just both looked at me, and I knew what was going on, and I just took over, and I did the entire presentation. I did their parts, too.
Yeah.
Okay? And afterwards, the founder just came to me, and he said, thanks, Eric, you know?
Yeah.
That guy wasn't going to listen to me. He listened to you.
Yeah.
And the guy ended up making a huge investment in the company.
Right. So. And then it did actually list. And how much longer after you had these, you were doing the fundraising, you got the backers, did it actually go?
Yeah, so... well, when you get so the Series C round from 3i was maybe 6 or 9 months before we listed. When you do the listing, there's something called the road trip, which takes place exactly 2 weeks before the listing date. So you choose the listing date. Ours was July 14th, 2015. So we started the road show 2 weeks before, and the purpose of the road show is to get people to commit to giving you money, to buying the stock on the day that you launch.
What was the date, Eric?
July 14th, 2005.
Oh, 2005.
Say 2005.
You said 2000, yeah.
Yeah, 2005.
I'm just on you. It's okay.
Okay, yeah. Well done. You're listening to me.
I'm trying.
Somebody's listening.
I'm not bored yet.
Okay. All right. Here, if you want a magazine, I'll give you an in-flight.
No. I'm still, you've got my attention. Please continue.
So it was 2005. The road trip was 2 weeks before. We went to Europe. We went to Hong Kong, Asia. We went to America. And the idea is that the day you list, when they say, okay, now there's a million shares for sale, that the people you've talked to all want to buy, and then your price goes up. So we had a successful listing. I wouldn't say the listing was brilliant. We listed at a total market cap of about $670 million. 18 months later, the company was valued at $7.5 billion.
What happened?
So we went up 10, 12 times in 18 months.
What? Because China was becoming...
China became the story.
Yeah.
We just hit the timing perfectly. When we listed, people weren't that keen on China, and then suddenly it was all China, China, China. We'll buy anything that's China.
And how did it fare through the global financial crisis?
Look, the company had its ups and downs, like any company did.
Like elevators.
Yeah. With four times as many people in them.
How many? I don't go through the numbers again.
Okay. So I think the $7.5 billion was the highest valuation we had. Eventually, the company settled in at about a $4 billion valuation, and they took it private. Yeah. So the company has now been privatized.
Right. Another private equity company came in and took it? Or they took back the shares?
It was a management buyout, or a leverage buyout. Yeah. So the management brought in money, and with VCs, they were able to take it private.
Okay.
And the company's still private, but I believe they're planning on a Chinese listing at some point.
So coming out of a career in advertising, this is a pretty nice, first gig right out of the chute, at the age 52, 53 years old.
Exactly. And that's what convinced me that this was a lot of fun. Right. It wasn't boring. It was very lucrative, and it was a way I could contribute, where I was essentially mentoring this guy. I'll tell you one anecdote, and I'm not making fun of him, but I think it's an important anecdote. He had never been outside of China in his life. Mm-hmm. We went to the U.S., we're on the road trip, and we're in Boston, and we fly to San Francisco, and we've got a 9 a.m. meeting the next day. Okay, we get in San Francisco like 3 a.m. or something. We all go to sleep. At 5:30 in the morning, our chairman is calling everybody, screaming, "Where are you? Why aren't you at the meeting? I'm waiting in the lobby." We say it's 5:30 in the morning. He says, no, it's not. It's 8:30 in the morning. Okay, in China, which from east to west is the same distance as the United States, there's only one time zone.
Right.
In America, in the continent, we have four time zones. Yeah. He didn't realize there were time zones in America. So the rest of us fly from Boston and San Francisco. We know there's a three-hour time difference. He thought he was still on Boston time, and he thought it was 8:30 in the morning, and we were all asleep at 5:30 in the morning.
That's brilliant. I love this.
Right. Now, I'm not making fun of the guy. What I'm saying is he came from a certain perspective, and he took that perspective and applied it to a new situation. Just the way a lot of Americans, they'll go to China, they'll say, okay, this is my perspective. Oh, wait, China doesn't work that way. There's only one time zone here. So that was something with my global career, having worked around the world for 30 years, I could mentor people as to the differences, how do they grow businesses, how do they move from one culture to the next.
That was part one of my interview with Eric Rosenkrantz, former vice chairman of Focus Media China and now founder and CEO of E3. In part two of our interview, that's the next episode, we're going to talk about intercultural mentoring and the startup culture of Southeast Asia. For that episode, or to download any of our episodes, you can find us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, inviting you to come in from the outside on Inside Asia.